good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for CS3330. I'm going to spend today talking about sort of generally what our course will go over and probably start a little bit of our first bit of material, which is hopefully review of, or mostly review of 2150 stuff. And hopefully this mic will cooperate and we won't have a buzzing sound all the time. So, in 2150, we started to learn that we have these layers of abstraction that, well, you know from starting CS that you probably didn't start by, like, putting together transistors and gates and the sort of low-level components you might have learned about if you took 2330, but you have this sort of higher-level language. And for the purpose of this class, our notion of a higher level language is going to be C. That's going to be our example. You might say, that's not very high level. And indeed it isn't, and that's precisely why we're using it. And you learned in 2150 that something like C or C++ gets turned into assembly. But that's not actually what the processor can use directly, but assembly is just kind of a more human readable representation of this machine code that the processor can interpret. And we're going to talk in this class about, well, how do you build hardware that can interpret some sort of machine code? And you might say, okay, you just put a bunch of gates together, but that's not really practical for something as complicated as a processor. So instead, we have these programming languages for hardware, which we'll call hardware design languages, where essentially you write a text description similar to, like, programs you've usually written, but rather than compiling to a program with machine code or something like that, it gets converted into a description of hardware to actually build, a set of gates for someone or some machine to set up. And that's sort of how we actually design things like processors. We don't actually, these days, generally go by, like, actually saying, we're going to put this transistor here. We have a higher level description to make that practical. So, questions? This sort of general high level overview. So, I mentioned we're going to be using C, and you might say, why did you make such a horrible choice? So, we have two things we like about C. So, one is that it's almost, it's not quite, but almost a subset of C++. So it's basically C++ with less stuff. And in theory, you already know about C++ from 2150. I know that the amount of knowing about C++ from 2150 may vary for you depending on when you took it, how well you were actually paying attention at the time, and so on. But that's what we're going to be trying to take advantage of. And we're going to not have tricky C++ features like classes or new and delete, IO streams, and so on to deal with because it's C, which is not doesn't have everything. But the probably more interesting attribute for this class about C++ is that it includes a direct correspondence to assembly, that you can look at something like C code, and you can say, okay, there's this assembly code that would be the most natural thing to generate. That, you know, if I have an add operation, that's going to turn into an add instruction. If I have a equals assignment operation, that's going to turn into a move instruction. If I have a comparison operation, that's going to turn into a comp instruction. There's this very straightforward correspondence that you can look at a piece of C code and produce sort of this canonical assembly code. And this is helpful for understanding the machine because we're going to talk about how the machine, like, runs machine code, but we don't actually want to deal by, like, showing you machine code and thinking about it that way. That's, like, really annoying. And it's even annoying to work from assembly code. You'd rather work from a higher level view, and C will sort of be our higher level view for what are we having the machine do. And we can think about how that turns into actual instructions on the machine. But there's a catch here. So there is this straightforward direct correspondence that you can do, and you might say, well, so that's what compilers do. And they don't. So compilers can be clever. And usually they're being clever because they think it will make your program faster. So even though there's this direct correspondence, it's not necessarily, and often not, what your compiler will actually do. We're using it because it's a good way of sort of showing C code as shorthand for assembly operations, but you should not assume that if you write a C program, you know, it's actually going to be that direct translation with a modern compiler if you tell it to make your program fast. Okay. So since we're using C, we're going to have a few assignments that actually involve writing C and some other assignments that involve using other programming tools like our hardware design language that need a Unix-like environment where you have a C compiler. And there's a few assignments, most notably the first assignment that's next week, not this week, where we actually need a 64-bit x86 Linux environment. You should have department accounts. Many of you should have gotten emails about accessing them. I understand there are some problems with the password reset page not working when it should be, but looking into that. And the department accounts will let you get SSH or sort of remote desktop access to department managed machines. And this is our officially supported way of accessing course computing resources and running course software, because we have IT people we can talk to if things break. We might do some best effort support of running things on your own machine, which many students prefer. But if you know there's 10 people waiting in office hours, we're going to tell you, please use the department servers rather than spending time debugging why a VM doesn't work in your machine. I'm sorry, we just can't spend our time that way. And I will say that though our canonical environment is a Linux one, except for a few assignments, most assignments will work directly on OS X if that's what you would prefer. So questions about computing environments? Okay. So talked about C. And then I have this assembly. And our assembly language of choice is going to be x86 64 assembly. Why do we choose that? Partly because that's what our textbook is based on. Partly because, in theory, you already know it from 2150, though I know the amount of already knowing it varies. And because of that, our first assignment is sort of meant to get you back up to speed with assembly so I can show assembly snippets on slides later on and not have a bunch of confused faces, hopefully, and we can talk about how that turns into something the processor can run. You may notice from my example here that I'm using the syntax that you didn't use in 2150, so x86 64 assembly. There are two ways of writing it. There's Intel syntax and AT&T syntax. We're going to use AT&T syntax in this course. The primary reason is because our textbook uses it and our assignments that deal with processor design very closely follow the textbook, and I would like to let you have that resource and have it be useful and not have to do translation on that when doing those assignments. That's the primary reason. Sort of the other reason is that it is the default in all the Linux tools for what type of assembly would be generated and expected. Questions on assembly. And I guess I should say that our first sort of major topic is we're going to go over AT&T syntax, since you kind of don't know it, sort of how it's different than Intel syntax, and also some things in assembly that you may have forgotten or not seen in 2150 that come up occasionally in this class, including on that first assignment next week. So then we're dealing with machine code. And you might say, OK, we're doing machine code, so it's going to be x86 64 machine code. And that is not what we're using. We're using this thing called y86, which is a subset of x86 64 made by our textbook authors with its own machine code that's very different than the real x86 64 encoding. And the x86 64 encoding is a lot more complicated, and in ways that aren't really very interesting, at least not for what we care about. So basically what happened is the x86 processor started with this old processor that was like 8-bit, then 16-bit, then 32-bit. And as they made these sort of changes to make registers bigger, go from 4 to 8 to 16 registers for general purpose operations, and add a bunch of instructions, they tried to keep the machine code very similar. So we have all these artifacts of the machine code kind of building up from this sort of history. And you know, that might be interesting from a historical perspective, but it's not interesting from a technical perspective, and it just would be really annoying to deal with, especially since we have assignments where we're sort of building a simulated processor, where we don't want to have to deal with 30 years of history just to figure out what an instruction is. Now, the machine code, even though it's sort of a toy subset of the assembly that's like less than you see in a real processor, it's still substantially more complicated than what you may have seen before. So for example, in 2150's IBCM, we have a bunch of features that Y86 has that just weren't there. So we have a variable length encoding, and that's something that even not all real machine codes use. It's kind of considered complicated in the hardware, but our textbook has chosen to have that feature. It has more than one register, which you'd expect pretty much any kind of useful processor to have, but you may remember IBCM did not. We have like full conditional jumps. We have stack manipulation instructions, which many architectures have chosen not to implement, but we're going to do that. So it is pretty complicated, but it's not complicated in the way the real x86-64 is. And the reason we're going to be so concerned about this particular machine code is that we're going to have you implement it in this hardware design language. Now, the hardware design language that we're going to use is called HCLRS. So it's based on the textbook's hardware design language, which is called HCL, but it's a version customized for this class in some ways. It is not a quote-unquote real hardware design language, but it's related to the sort of things we use in industry. And since it's not a real hardware design language, I don't actually have an implementation that compiles it to hardware. So we're going to have something which takes your hardware description and simulates it instead. And that's what we're going to use, but it's sort of the same idea as what you do if you were using one of the commercial hardware design languages like Verilog and VHDL, just with some of the annoying things needed to make things work physically omitted, so we can focus on sort of the abstractions we actually care about talking about in this class. And because we're using something very similar to the textbook's hardware language design and the textbook's machine code, our assignments that do this processor development follow the textbook very closely. Other assignments, not so closely. But that's why the textbook is listed as required, because you probably don't technically need it, but it would be really nice to have it, given that the textbook essentially contains instructions for parts of the assignment. So questions about HCL, hardware description languages, generally? Okay. So we're building processors, and it's worth talking about sort of what is a processor really? And we can think of a computer as having a processor, which does computation, and a memory which stores data. So is there any components that I should also have to have something called a computer? Anything that you think probably should be in this picture, this is meant to represent a computer? Or is it just processors and memory and they have to be connected to each other? So we can get the data to compute on, store the data we compute on. Yeah?
Some way to get data into and out of the computer?
Yeah, so we need some way of doing input and output. So we're going to have this start with this simple model of how a processor would work, where to start out, the processor is connected to memory via what I'll call a bus, so just some communication line, where the processor can send stuff and the memory can send stuff back. And sort of the basic operation is that we're going to send an address to get stuff to manipulate in memory and either send data to put there or send data to get there. But we have to add the ability to talk to input and output devices, keyboards, mice, networks, disk drives, some way of getting data in and out. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to expand this model by adding what I'll call an I/O bridge, where we'll say we're going to have the same way of communicating via this output line, this what I call the memory bus from the processor, and we'll have this hardware device we call this bridge, which decides, is this something for the I/O device or for the memory? But the protocol will be the same. That is, the processor will say, here's an address, do this thing with this, you know, read or write from this address. And some addresses will be things, I/O devices, like, say, the keyboard, and some addresses will be memory. And the I/O bridge will figure out which is which. So this is our simple model of how a processor exists in a computer. And I say it's simple, meaning that it's not really true, because there's going to be a bunch of exceptions, some of which we'll talk about this semester. This is where we're going to start, this idea of how a processor works. So if we think of executing some instructions, so the processor is going to have some storage that's not in the memory, most likely. For example, it's probably going to store what we'll call a program counter, which is the address of the current instruction to run. And it's going to need to retrieve machine code. So it sends that program counter, which is, you know, ultimately stored in here with a bunch of registers that aren't part of the memory. And the memory sends back the machine code corresponding to that address. Well, it's just the data corresponding to that address. The memory doesn't actually know it's machine code. It just knows, here's an address, give me the data for it. And the processor is going to interpret that as machine code. Now, on this slide, I've shown you it as assembly. It's probably not going to be stored that way, because making a processor that, like, looks for P followed by a U is possible, but probably needlessly slow. Like, we could make that processor, but we have this machine code with a more easily machine parsed format in order to avoid the overhead of dealing with that. But in this case, we've received a push instruction. And if you remember how the push instruction works, we're going to need to write a value from a register to the stack. So the processor is going to get this machine code and figure out what it means. And it's going to determine that it means it needs to write a value from a register. Well, where's the registers? It's part of the processor storage. And it needs to figure out where to write it, which is the stack. How does it know where the stack is? Well, these registers include our PC, we saw RBP, and also our stack pointer, which on x86-64 would be RSP. So it's going to use that to send a request to the memory to actually do the operation this instruction wants to do, which is write a value to a memory address. It's going to tell the memory, hey, here's the address, write this value to it. And the memory is going to say, yep, done that. And then we finished executing this push instruction, and the next thing we want to do is look for the next instruction in the program. So we need to fetch the machine code that comes after it, so we add to the PC to get to the next instruction, and retrieve that instruction, do the same process over again. And this sort of loop is what our processors are doing. Just keep doing this until for indefinitely. Get the machine code for something, do what that machine code says, which might involve contacting memory once more, might not, and so on. So questions about this process I've shown? And I mentioned we have this I/O bridge, so the way that would work is we'd run an instruction which, like, uses an address that corresponds to an I/O device, and we get back the same way we get back a memory value, say, a key press or some other similar input or output information. So we have this abstraction that tells us how our processors work. So given that, let's say I have this instruction here, which I've written in AT&T and Intel syntax, which reads from a memory location into RAX. So the question is, if the processor in this model is running this instruction, how many times does it send a message on that memory bus, that output line? So So someone want to volunteer an answer? No, so I'm just saying this is one instruction, which is one line, but I've written it in two different ways. Just to run that one line, how many times does it send a message on that output line, that memory bus? You say twice? Okay, can you tell me what the two times are? Yeah, so get the instruction. And the other time you say to send the data, what do you mean? Can you be more specific? What data are we talking about? Okay, so you say doing the operation. Now, what information actually goes out over the bus? Someone want to tell me that to do that? Like, what do we actually need to tell the memory to do this operation? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying the value in the register. So what is the memory going to do with that? Take the value and store it? Is that what you said? What did you say? So can you repeat that? Sorry.
Yes. I said the CPU would send, or the top center would send both the value in the register and the location on the memory for that value to store.
Okay, so that would be, so I guess I need to be careful. This is an instruction which reads from the memory, doesn't write to it.
Oh, okay. So.
Which I know is confusing because something, we haven't gone over AT&T syntax yet, but AT&T syntax is in this direction, Intel syntax is in the other direction. And that is indeed something that we will go over again because it comes up a lot. And it's unfortunate that no one agreed on which order to write assembly in. So. But that means that we aren't going to send a value to write. So what are we going to send to the memory? Yeah. So we're going to send the address. Yeah. So address send, address to read, and get the value read. So something notable that we aren't sending is we aren't telling the memory anything about RAX, because that's just entirely on the processor. These registers here are just in the processor. The memory doesn't know about them, and the memory also doesn't know what instruction it was. It just gave us the bytes that are its machine code. So questions about this scenario? What is the second? Which second?
I think you're talking about the bottom right. It looks kind of
like chicken scratch. Oh. Send the address. Oh, sorry. Yes, my handwriting. So send the address to read. Read, which is specifically in this case, OX. And it still probably looks bad. And get the revalue read. I also have this prepared typewritten slide. This is a little more compact. Other questions? Yeah.
Is the first step, does that include the program counter step, or is that just a...
The question is the first step separate from the program counter step? The first step is exactly the program counter step. So retrieving the instruction we do by telling the memory, this is my program counter. We actually don't tell it it's the program counter. We give it the address of the program in the program counter, and it gives us the value there, which is machine code. Other questions? Okay, so we've gone sort of over this sort of basic idea of what this processor we're going to be designing does from a very, very high level. And some people have complained in the past about this class that, gosh, you know, it's nice to learn how to build processors, but I'm never going to do that. I don't care about ever doing that. I'm never going to write any C-like language again, because I don't like any language with pointers again. Don't want to deal with that. So why should I care about this class? And there's some things that I would hope that might be useful to you, even if you don't actually care about hardware or using a language with pointers and so on. So one thing is that we're going to learn things about designing hardware, which are going to give us insights into a bunch of things, program performance, what compilers are actually doing, so you can use compilers more effectively, hopefully, and what happens when you do weird things in your program, like the things that cause seg faults. Yeah. That might be useful to you even if you aren't actually like designing hardware professionally or so on. First, on program performance. So you might say, well, I learned how assembly works. I have a pretty kind of sort of good idea of like how compilers generate assembly, or at least I can look at that compiler's output and see what the assembly is if I really need to. And, well, you know, I just count how many instructions run, right? If it's less instructions, it's going to be faster. And that's a naive model, which may have worked historically, but modern hardware really makes that not a good way of estimating performance. And there's two big things that modern hardware does that we're going to talk about a bunch in this class, which make this a bad way of estimating performance. So one of them is parallelism. Modern hardware does multiple things at once. It executes multiple instructions, possibly different parts of the instructions, but multiple instructions at once. And this is more than just like multi-threading or multiple cores. There's other ways in which the hardware executes parts of different instructions at the same time that we're going to learn about. And as a programmer, this matters to you if you care about performance, because whether the hardware can do that effectively depends on what instructions you give it. If you give instructions that it has to finish one instruction before it can start the next, it doesn't matter that it's capable of doing multiple instructions at once. It's not going to be able to do that for you. So by knowing sort of how these mechanisms work, you can write programs that give the hardware multiple things to do so you can get the full usage of these parallel components. And the other big way in which hardware doesn't follow this sort of one instruction is one time unit model is caching. So that model I showed you where our processor talks to the memory is not true. And instead, what you'll see the hardware do is that we'll have a cache, which I will represent with a dollar sign for cache, next to the processor, that's going to be faster than sending something all the way to the memory. And the processor is going to try to store things in that smaller but much faster storage that doesn't involve going on this slow communication line. And when it can do that successfully, your program runs a lot faster. When it can't, it runs a lot slower. And typically, the sort of algorithm used to determine what to put there is it looks for things that were basically recently used. And you can write your program in a way where you ensure that the things that you're likely to access will be recently used such that they'll be in that cache. You can make that more likely by understanding sort of how the processor is going to choose what to put in that slow, faster, smaller storage. And these are both things that are complementary to what you've learned in all your other classes about making programs fast. The big focus we have in other classes is Big O. Big O is great, and these are all things you can do in tandem with making the Big O right. Yeah. So these are all constant factors, we'd say, but they can be very large constant factors, and they're things you do in addition to choosing the right asymptotic time complexity algorithm to get good performance out of a modern processor. So questions about these ways in which hardware violates our one instruction is one time unit principle? Okay. So another thing we're going to learn a bit about is what compilers are and do. And you kind of know a lot about that. You've seen like generating assembly files and what they look like. But there's some steps that we've kind of glossed over that we're going to go into more detail about. So one of those is that you can have multiple assembly files and make one application from them. So we're going to talk about how that happens. And knowing this would help you understand when that doesn't work. What's an undefined reference? Why is that a thing that happens sometimes and not other times? What's going on? And also things that are generally helpful for if you want to make compilers at some point, or if you want to figure out what's going on in your debugger, because your debugger is dealing with after the compiler did all its stuff. Another topic we'll cover is weird program behaviors. One of the things we're going to talk about when we talk about designing hardware is providing support for things like operating systems. And one of the things operating systems need to deal with is when programs, for example, misbehave. And probably the most prominent example of this you've seen is segmentation fault. So segmentation fault means the program did something that it, quote unquote, shouldn't have done, and the operating system got involved with help from the hardware. We're going to talk about in detail the sort of system that makes that sort of thing happen, how the operating system can set up the program to be able to access some memory, not others. And this can give you insight into things like, why does accessing things out of bounds only sometimes give me a seg fault? How do I determine when that is or isn't going to happen? We're going to know more about how that system works, so you can have a better understanding of why segmentation faults sometimes happen and sometimes don't. And also, if you wanted to write something like an OS, how you would do that, what the hardware is going to give you to do that, what that interface that the OS is using to talk to the hardware looks like. So, questions? This? Fun? Okay. So, now we've gone over things that might make this class useful, if you didn't think it was just intrinsically useful to learn about how hardware works. I'm going to talk a bit about logistics. So lecture and lab attendance. I'm not going to check lecture or lab attendance. Lectures will be recorded, assuming there's no technical difficulties, which hopefully will happen, but and remote submission of labs is possible. We aren't going to check that you attend your lab. You can do it on your own. We're not going to care, but the TAs are there, and the intention is that you can do the labs in the lab time. And you can also work with other people in the lab time, which might be valuable. If you decide to rely on lecture recordings, I have some recommendations. Just things are worth pointing out that I think are mostly obvious, but you should have a regular schedule of watching them, so you get into habits that maybe if you weren't coming to class, you would. If you were coming to class, you'd have a habit of coming to class, hopefully. You should have something similar. You should try to actually answer in lecture questions rather than just skimming through it. And I would recommend having a place to write down questions you have and actually ask them afterwards. Go to Piazza or office hours or something and actually go through your questions that you should have asked if the lecture was in person. So that's on lectures and labs. So we have coursework. So we mentioned labs. So labs, the grading for labs is that there's some threshold of an amount you need to complete to get full credit, which is often less, a little bit less than everything in the lab. And on labs, collaboration is permitted. So you can work with everyone else in the lab. You can work with other people in the class. That's fine. The intent is to kind of prepare you for homeworks primarily, and the grading is pretty loose. Now, I can't just do did you hand something in grading, because if you hand in something where basically nothing's done, since we aren't checking attendance, I have no way of knowing you actually worked on it. So we have to judge on what you submit, but our intention is that if you spend something around the lab time on it, you should get full credit, but obviously we can't fully guarantee that because we can just look at what you submitted. And there are homework assignments. So most homework assignments are kind of introduced by the lab. So the lab is kind of your practice, where you can work with everyone else. Then there's an individual homework assignment in which you may not share code, pseudocode, your detailed notes about what code to write, and so on. And they'll be due by 9:30 a.m. each lab day. Why 9:30? Because that's when the first lab starts. We don't want you working on the previous homework during the lab time instead of working on the lab. There will also be weekly quizzes. These are take-home, open notes, open books on a website released on Thursday, some hours after this, some not immediately after, so I can adjust the questions if we don't get to something, and due before the first lecture on Tuesday. I will give a demo of the quiz system on Thursday. And there will be a final exam. We have a combined, meaning both sections of the class, final exam time during which it will be. So questions on coursework? Yes? Labs are, it's not mentioned on the slide. They're due at the end of the lab day, meaning 11:59 p.m. Yes? This question is the 9:30 a.m. the following after the lab? Yes. So, for example, next week lab will introduce our bomb assignment, and the corresponding homework we do the following week. Other questions? Yes. What do? Weekly quizzes will be due before the 9:30 lecture on Tuesday. Yes. Question is, you only have one day to do the lab. Most labs will be posted in advance. And if you want to do them in advance, that's fine with me. Or probably all labs will be posted at least a day in advance, but often much more. Yes? So your question is, on the lab day, at 9:30 a.m., the previous homework is due. Please note that this due time is not advice to be finishing up the lab on Wednesday morning, sorry, the homework on Wednesday morning. Please actually try to finish it up like Monday or Tuesday or earlier. That would be great. It's just giving you the maximum possible time without having people coming to lab and working on the homework and asking the TAs about the prior homework. Lab is due the same day, yes. You can start the lab earlier. I'm not going to stop you. But the intention is that you can do the lab in the 75 minutes that are scheduled for the lab time. Yes?
Is there one lab that's opted out
for the lab time? Sorry, one lab that's... So questions about skipping assignments I'll get to late and so on later. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned we have our textbook. So this is our textbook here. Labs and homeworks might be a little desynced with lectures because I try to make sure I cover things before we get to them in labs and homeworks and lectures, but that doesn't mean that necessarily the lab or homework on that topic will be right away, just because, you know, we have certain labs and they don't always match up, so it might be like a week or two late, just a warning. So sometimes we'll cover something in lecture and you'll see it a week or two later in lab or homework. That can happen. Quizzes. So I mentioned release Thursday night, due Tuesday before the first lecture. They'll mostly cover lecture material. The two lowest quiz grades will be dropped. No questions asked, just dropped. For other things, late policy. So generally, if you have exceptional circumstances, if you're sick, family situation, etc., contact us, me probably. I can make exceptions on a case-by-case basis. It's easier to make exceptions if you contact me earlier, or we can have you do assignments earlier parts of assignments early or something like that, or just generally have more flexibility. Otherwise, the no questions asked late policy for homeworks only, not for labs, quizzes, etc. For homeworks only, if it's 0 to 48 hours late, it's minus 10%. If it's 48 to 72 hours late, it's minus 15%. Otherwise, no credits. And that's not a sliding scale. If it's 1 hour late, it's minus 10%. If it's 47 hours late, it's minus 10%. For quizzes and labs, generally, we won't accept late submissions. We can make exceptions to that sometimes. The biggest issue is for quizzes, we release answers automatically. So, and often I'll discuss them in the first lecture. So it's kind of hard to let you submit them late if I've talked about the specific question in lecture. And for quizzes, so for labs, we sometimes release the lab answers after the lab is due. So I can't generally just let you submit them late if the answer is posted on the website. We can figure something out in case exceptional circumstances for quizzes that often would be dropping a quiz that you like were ill for or something. So questions on late policy? Okay, getting help. For non-real-time help, I'll primarily be looking at Piazza. For labs, they're in person. The TAs will be there. You can ask them about things that aren't the lab as long as they're getting not skipping people who need help with the lab. And office hours, there's a calendar on the website. We're going to try, and hopefully it will work out okay, doing a split of in-person and remote office hours. We noted on the calendar which are which. Generally, office hours after 7 p.m. or on weekends will be remote, as well as a few times during the week, and other office hours will be in person is the current plan. We might adjust that depending on demand and so on. Remote office hours will be via Discord. In-person office hours will always be in person. We have an online queue that will be used for remote office hours and may or may not be used for in-person office hours. It should be obvious if you go to the room whether or not that's the case. I will note, since there's some people get annoyed about this, the way the office hour queue works, except for about the first three slots, it's sorted by the last time you were helped. And the TAs have the option of resetting and reordering by the last time you were helped manually. The intention of this is that if you go on the office hour queue at, say, 10 p.m. before 9 a.m. office hours, the TA can reset that so you don't get any advantage for doing so, especially since I very much doubt that if we came at 4 a.m. that you would be ready to be helped. And this is trying to spread out the help. Ideally, the office hour queue algorithm wouldn't matter because we'd have plenty of TAs, but that's usually not quite the case. So questions on office hour logistics? I guess I should say, yeah.
So also an in-person office hour have
the
online queue, right?
The question is, will in-person office hours have the online queue? That will vary. It should be obvious from the room or from the online queue if it's being used. Basically, if the room's small enough, we might just use a whiteboard. Or quiet enough. Otherwise, we might use the online queue. It's up to the TA running the office hours. Yeah. Question is, where will it be? That will be announced on the calendar. I'm going to try not to use stacks because I anticipate that being in the same room that 1110 and 2150 is trying to use might be a bad idea if I have other options. And I think I might be able to get Olson 1 a lot of the time. But we'll see. Room availability is always a mess. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, because homeworks are individual, does that mean you can't ask TAs for help? You can ask for TAs for help on homeworks. And you can do it during lab times. If you're asking for help about not the lab during lab times, TAs might say, sorry, I have to help people with the lab first, but you can absolutely do that. TAs are generally responsible for not giving you help you're not supposed to get. Obviously, there might be some circumstances where you might be trying too hard, but generally it's the EA's job to know how they're not supposed to help you. Not yours. Yeah. So the question is, when's the last time help me? So that means that if you got help last week, and someone else this is their first time as office hours using the queue, and someone else got helped yesterday, you're going to go in between the two. So the person who got help yesterday has the lowest priority among those three. Does that make sense? As I said, hopefully we'll have enough office hours where the queue's just small enough that it's not a big deal, but this is my compromise I've tried to make things not have a very small number of people get all the TA time. Okay, other questions? Okay. And I'll mention the upcoming lab and homework. So next week's lab and the homework that follows that is due the following week is called the bomb lab and homework. And basically, you're going to be given an executable. And using a debugger and disassembler, you need to figure out the correct input for it, because you were not going to have the full source code to do that. And this involves a bunch of x86-64 assembly, so if you feel like that was a sore spot for you in 2150, you could spend some time reviewing that. That might be a reasonable way to prep. Okay, no quiz demo today. Okay. So I mentioned this idea of memory, and to talk about what memory is from sort of our view, is we're going to think of memory as an array of bytes. And in this class, bytes are going to be 8 bits. And each of the elements of this array has an address, an index. And in this case, I've drawn the numerically largest address on top and the numerically smallest address on bottom. But I could have also written this the other way. And it's the same values, same array. Like there's nothing different. I just wrote it differently. Now, this is an array of bytes, but oftentimes, when we think about instructions, we aren't actually dealing with individual bytes, we're dealing with something larger. So for example, this is C code which takes the address 42000 and converts it to a pointer to an integer. And on our department machines, an integer is 4 bytes. And it takes that 4 bytes and prints out the value there. But if we look at address 42000, there's only 1 byte there. So how do we get 4 bytes from that? Well, the answer is that we actually read multiple entries in this array, 4 of them, because we have 4 bytes. And the convention we'll always follow is that we start with the address that's in that pointer and take the numerically following addresses to get our 4 bytes. So 4200 up to 42003. So now we have 4 different byte values, but we want to print them out as a single number, a single 32-bit number. And there are 2 reasonable choices on how to do this. So one choice is we can say that this numerically lowest address, the one we started with, is going to be the least significant part of the number. And the other is we can say it's going to be the most significant part. And there have been processors that have made both of these choices. There's not really a big advantage or disadvantage to any of them. The first one is called little endian. The way I describe it is least significant byte, lowest address. The other one's big endian. The most significant byte has the lowest address. So it's named after how important the lowest address is to the numerical value. Least significant, think ones place. So the ones place is in the lowest address in little endian and is not in the lowest address in big endian. So we can get these two different values, depending on which we choose. In this class, we're always going to use little endian. So we don't have to worry about big endian, but I want you to know it exists and that we have to make a choice here. So questions about endianness? Okay, no questions. So let's do a bit of little exercise on endianness. So there's a bunch of secret here. I'm going to go through that first. So what we have here is we set up a buffer, which I'm representing with this picture. It's an 8-byte buffer. Unsent carriers are 1 byte long. And I have 8 of them. They're initially all zeros. And I also have 2 32-bit values. UN32T means an unsigned 32-bit value, which I've stored these two numbers. And then I get pointers to those values, but rather than getting pointers to them as 32-bit values, I get pointers to them as bytes. So we can think of, you know, this is a 32-bit value, so it's going to be stored in memory in 4 bytes, and I get a pointer that points to the beginning of that. And it points to it as bytes. The initial pointer we started out with here points to it as a whole integer, just this whole box rather than an individual piece. Does that make sense? Questions? So then, once we have it a way of accessing the individual bytes of these integers, we copy them to different parts of the buffer. So we copy from value 1 to the first 4 entries of the buffer, and from value 2 to the next 4 entries of the buffer using this for loop. Then we copy from the buffer back into value 1, but not starting at index 0 like we initially did, but starting at index 1. And the question is, what is the resulting value of value 1 after we run this code? So I'll give you some time. You can discuss with your neighbors, see if you agree. And also, you'll note that there's the picture of what's going on here. We store these two values in the buffer and copy out this into value 1, those 4 bytes. Okay, who would like some more time? So, not seeing volunteers, so who thinks it's A, B, C, okay, D, E, F, okay, G, okay, H, and I, something else. Okay, so we have a lot of people who think it's F. Is that right? So, and little consensus otherwise. So let's look at what goes on here. So we have our value 1 and value 2, and remember, we're little endian. So the least significant byte of value 1 is in this first slot of the number. So the first byte is 7, 8. And then 5, 6, and so on. Because bytes are the thing in memory, those are the things that we have to have an order for. And then we copy those bytes into the buffer. And we get the same bytes in the buffer. So questions about what happened so far, why we I divided the two numbers into those bytes in that way? So then we copy the 4 bytes out of the buffer here. And we have 5, 6, 3, 4, 1, 2, and F0. So that's going to be the bytes in value 1. But we need to interpret that back as a normal number. So the way we do that is we're little endian. So the lowest address is the least significant part. It's where the ones place is. So 5, 6 goes to our ones place. Then 3, 4, 1, 2, F0. We're building it up in the way we write it in code, which is what I showed below. So, which was not the majority answer. So questions on how I got this. So I guess something which I think people might have missed is that notice that we aren't breaking up bytes into pieces because, well, that's what the memory works on. So we don't actually like reorder bytes within themselves. They stay together. Because there's not like addresses for parts of bytes here. We just have a byte or not. Yes? Yes, so the correct answer would have been G. Other questions? Yes. Okay, so that's about endianness and thinking about things as sequences of bytes, which comes up a bunch because that's what our processors are dealing with. So to finish up, I'm going to talk a bit about assembly. So we're going to talk about AT&T syntax because that's what our textbook uses and what we're going to use for a bunch of things. So we kind of need to explain it. And we're also going to review some things in assembly that you've either probably not remembered well from 2150 because they kind of came up in passing or which weren't covered in 2150. So for AT&T versus Intel syntax, I'll start with this example. So this is an instruction that takes the value 42 and moves it to memory at a location specified by the register RBX, and it's a 8-byte value. And you'll see that like the AT&T version and the Intel version are very different, and there's also a bunch of extra line noise or funny characters in the AT&T version. So we'll go through them. So the most notable difference for AT&T syntax is that the destination is going to be last. A way I got kind of like reminding myself of this is I might write an arrow in this direction to remind myself how the instruction works for the last, between the last operand and the second to last operand. That's what that instruction does. It's 42 into something related to RBX. When you see parentheses around a register, that's a value in memory. It's not square brackets. As we'll talk about a little later, the rule is basically actually that if there's not specified otherwise, it's, you know, if we have a number alone, there's also a value in memory. We'll get to that later. And here, this dollar sign represents a constant. So you might say, what if there wasn't a dollar sign? If there wasn't a dollar sign, that would be whatever's at memory address 42. But there's a dollar sign here, so it's the constant 42 that gets moved. And registers are always written with a percent sign here. If there's no percent sign, it's not a register, it's a label instead. Label meaning that some, you know, if it was just RBX without a percent sign, we'd expect there to be RBX colon elsewhere in the assembly file or some other assembly file. And this Q on the instruction, so it's a move instruction, but we write move Q. The Q represents the length. Q is for quad, 8 bytes, which not very intuitive, but basically their canonical length was 2 bytes, 16 bits. So L is for long, is 4 bytes. W for word is 2 bytes, and B for byte is 1 byte. And this can be omitted if it's implied by the context. In this case, we need the information because we don't know whether the constant 42 is an 8-byte value or a 4-byte value. Both of those are valid instructions that we could write. So questions about this example here? These rules I've shown you for AT&T syntax. Yes. So question is, when would you not need parentheses? So if I do instead move Q 42 into RBX, this sets the register RBX, not a memory location, to 42. Is that a reasonable example?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes. Question is, that's 42 in decimal? Yes. If you want it to be hexadecimal, you like C, you would write an OX. Other questions? Yeah. So, which you're saying the thing on the.
So, you can move or MOV Q, and that Q signifies that it's 8 bytes?
Yes.
But is the 42 like 8 bytes?
Question is, when I say for the move that I just wrote into RBX, when I write it Q that says it's 8 bytes, so is the 42 8 bytes? So, it's saying that 8 bytes are going to be moved. And conceptually, 42 is an 8-byte constant. It might not be stored that way in the machine code, however. In fact, it usually won't be. But we're saying that the actual moving that the processor will do will write 8 bytes. Other questions? Yes. So you're saying 42 is an unsigned integer, so you're wondering how it impacts.
So like, think of it as like 8 bytes in the first place.
So the question is, what would it mean for it to be 8 bytes? So that means that, you know, if we're gonna have a bunch of leading zeros, that we're gonna RBX has 64 bits, right? 8 bytes. We're going to set all of them with this move instruction. Or for the memory version, we're going to set 8 bytes of memory, which means that if we have something like 42, there's a bunch of leading zeros, they all get set. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is sort of kind of on the simple end. If you remember x86-64 assembly, you remember that we can actually write much more complex instructions, in particular instructions that access memory in a kind of complex way. And this is where the biggest difference between Intel syntax and AT&T syntax is. So in Intel syntax, you can write this kind of formula for how to compute a memory address, and you just have to know what types of formulas are allowed. In AT&T syntax, this is given to you as kind of a fill-in-the-slots thing. So there's a value you add, which is written before parentheses by convention, and then these sort of kind of operands in parentheses, where the first one is called the base register, and the second one's called the index register. And the operation that's done is we take the base register, we add the index register times the scale value here, and add this integer at the beginning, which is called the displacement. So that's just the rule for what that is. Yes, you can like look this up. And that's what they chose. Yes?
Will the recorded lecture have your writing on?
The question is, will the recorded lecture have my writing? Yes.
Okay.
Won't make the handwriting better, but it will have my writing. Other questions? Okay, so you can see this on this. We have this displacement in front, and our base register, our index, and our scale. And kind of the purpose, the reason why the processor supports this type of addressing is they have arrays in mind. So the reason why it's called a base, an index, and a scale is that if you think of RBX being the address of an array, you can think of RCX as an index in the array where, in this case, the entries are 4 bytes. And this will compute the address within that array. Plus some offset. Yes?
I guess it doesn't really work, but I was wondering, like, what if you omitted some of those?
Question is, what if I, can I omit parts of this? You know, sometimes I don't want to scale in an index. And the answer is, yes. You can. There's defaults that are mostly sensible. So I started with the most general version, but you can omit a bunch of things, and for the most part, it works the way you'd kind of guess. So you can omit the index and just use a base address if you don't care about. Sorry, make the scale. Just use the base if you don't care about accessing something like an array. You can just use an index and a scale if your displacement is your base address instead of having it in a register, and a whole bunch of other options. So something I should note is that this scale, it looks like it can be any number. That's not true. The only values that are allowed for this are 1, which is the default, 2, 4, and 8. Everything else just doesn't work. So you might say, what if I have an array with 12-byte values? Well, in that case, you use a multiply instruction. Questions? Yeah. Okay. And so with this idea that you can omit things, so if we omit the index, it basically defaults to 0, and the same with the base. If we omit the scale, it defaults to 1, basically, which is what's happening down here. And if we omit everything in parentheses, which we can do, it just is a constant memory address. So that's why we need a dollar sign for constants. If you don't have it there, it's a memory address. It's the form of this with where you just forgot all the registers, but you have an address, which is often causes some confusion. So questions? Yes. Okay. And somehow I'm faster than the other lecture. And okay, one last thing that AT&T versus Intel Syntex that we've already mentioned, but this is a non-obvious consequence of something we've mentioned. The destination is lost. And for the subtract instruction, this has some consequences that you're probably used to from Intel Syntex. The subtract instruction, you know, is the first operand minus the second. Well, the first operand is the destination, and it's still the same instruction, still does the same computation. So the way I like thinking of this is subtract from. That's what it does. And also affected by this is the compare instruction. The compare instruction, as we'll learn later, does this operation. It does a subtraction and compares it to zero, which is not how you probably learn this compare instruction, but that's kind of what's really happening under the hood. And we'll talk about that in more detail in a few days. Yes?
I'm not sure if I'm wrong with this, right, but can you add negative signs in front of the registers and then negative?
So the question is, can I add negative signs in front of the registers
or,
in the assembly? Sorry? Can I have, so you can have negative, question is about negative numbers. So registers can have negative numbers in them, which is the same as far as the processor is concerned for subtraction as having positive numbers because it's 2's complement. Sorry, unsigned numbers, I should say. You can have constants which are negative. So add negative 1 to REX, for example. That's a valid instruction, so you can have negative constants, and that works the way you'd expect, and basically, most of the time, the constants in the instruction are signed numbers. Yes?
Since both the REX and RA is 8-byte, can we not use...
Sorry, since both REX and... So both of them are 8 bytes, so can you not use...
Use it with a Q.
So they're 8 bytes, so Q is the size for 8. I know it's quad, so it sounds like it should be 4, but it's really 8 because the base is 2 bytes, is the base size they're multiplying by 4. Does that make sense?
I just mean, can we use it without...
Yes. Yeah, the question is, can you do this without the Q? Yes, you can. Because this is one of those cases where there's only one possible size. Yeah. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. See you on Thursday.